to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts this morning, together here with Mr. Dennis Hart.
Hi, it's good to be with you again on this sparkling Monday after a little bit of rain on Sunday night. That was nice.
It is going to be a very, very pleasant week.
It is.
Basically, what is predicted for the entire week is sun and temperatures in the mid-80s. And rain is possible on Friday night and Saturday, and then it's back to sunny weather.
I don't think it gets much better than that in Iowa in late July, early August. Great weather, great time to get out and walk, and maybe you'll see some wild things while you're out walking. I always do in the neighborhood around here anyway.
Dennis, we've gotten some feedback on the wild things.
We have.
A number of people have said they don't believe that spiders have eight eyes.
That was something that a friend of mine asked me when we were having a beverage at our favorite downtown Main Street Cafe last week. Eight eyes for a spider? Come on. Did Ursula make that up? And I said, I don't think so. So could you explain, please?
This all started because we ran into a wolf spider in my father's basement. And so we did catch him and we put him outside. I was wondering, too, like, why would this spider need eight eyes? Because if you look at a picture of a wolf spider, in fact, it does have eight eyes, and two of them are very, very large.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I read about it, it just said, well, they just have to have terrific peripheral vision because they don't have webs. They have to hunt. And so all these various eyes provide kind of peripheral vision that you need. But then you brought it up again. Because you said that you'd gotten some feedback that people were skeptical.
Yes.
In fact, so I looked up a little bit more, and I found this very interesting article than as usual in Nature. It gets much more complicated than I thought. This has to do with something that we can't even fathom as human beings. So this is what I found out. Joaquin Ortega Escobar from the University of Madrid, Spain, has been looking into spiders, and he explains that they keep track of the direction and distance traveled on the outbound leg of a hunt, in other words, when they set out to hunt, so that they can return home along the most direct route instead of retracing their steps. They don't want to take all the detours back. They want to go directly home. And he says the animals rely on a polarized light compass associated with the pair of eyes at the top of their head to determine their orientation, and they have an odometer that measures the movement of images across the retina of the eye to determine the distance covered. But it wasn't clear which of the eyes actually they used to track, and so he did an experiment, and he found that the two outermost pairs of eyes on the front of the head hold the key to the spider's ability to keep track of how far it has traveled. And he says they probably integrate the information gathered through the anterior lateral eyes and the posterior medium eyes to get an image of changes observed in the territory, and they use this for orientation when returning to their burrow after looking for prey. So how's that for complicated technology? It's all about the brain, infinite variety of what the brain can do in all sorts of species upon this planet.
Right. It is complex, isn't it?
We don't have a polarized light compass, so I'm not even sure what that is.
I had one, but I lost it years ago.
Well, what was it like? So did you get home quicker that way?
No, it did. As a matter of fact, it took me longer.
That's the gist of it.
Thank you for clarifying all of it. It was so good.
Well, there's much more, Mr. Hart.
We don't have time, though, do we?
Okay, give us the news, Mr. Hart.
I will. And on this Monday, we normally start with news from around Iowa, and we will get to that in just a few seconds, but we need to start with another mass shooting that took place, this time in California. 7:30 last night, Iowa time, 5:30 California time, at the Gilroy Garlic Festival. Gilroy, a town about 80 miles south of San Francisco on U.S. Highway 101. A gunman went in and shot and killed three people and wounded at least 15 others, one of the dead, a six-year-old boy, before police shot him to death. There is, at this moment, no motive for it. Police think there might have been a second person involved. They are not sure. Gilroy Garlic Festival, very famous out in California. It's been going on for 40 years. 100,000 people attend it. It's always on the last Friday. Starts on the last Friday of July, and this weekend turned absolutely tragic out there. As always, there was a lot of news around Iowa, of course, last week as well. And we will start with word that the federal government announced it would execute an Iowa man next year in one of the first federal executions since 2003. 51-year-old Dustin Lee Honkin was convicted in 2004 in one of the state's most heinous mass murders, shooting 5 people to death, including 2 girls who were 6 and 10 years old. The bodies were hidden in northern Iowa. Honkin was arrested for drug offenses in 1996, and the bodies were found 4 years later. He received a federal death sentence in 2005. The state of Iowa does not have the death penalty for crimes as prosecuted in its state courts. Meanwhile, U.S. Justice Department officials announced on Friday that a man wanted in connection with 2 shooting deaths in Chicago had been captured in Clive. Authorities arrested 33-year-old Connie Miles Jr. at a convenience store on Hickman Road in Clive. In other news last week, top Republicans in the state legislature said they would not investigate a claim by former state agency director Jerry Foxhoven that Governor Kim Reynolds had forced him out last month after he refused to do something questionable. Foxhoven quit as director of the Iowa Department of Human Resources on June 17th. Republican State House Speaker Linda Upmeyer called Foxhoven's allegation vague, and she shot down a request by House Democrats to have the chamber's Republican-led Oversight Committee look into it. But Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand, who is a Democrat, said he planned to investigate the matter. Then later last week, it was reported that after Foxhoven was forced out, he objected to having his agency continue paying an administrator who had transferred to the governor's office. Stay tuned. There'll be more on this one this week, we're sure. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence came to Iowa last week, making a speech in which he urged Congress to pass the new trade deal with Mexico and Canada that had been negotiated with President Trump. The vice president went to Ankeny to the headquarters of AccuMold, a company that creates structures for high-tech uses. Pence also praised Iowa Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, who support the trade deal. Meanwhile, Senator Ernst made news of her own last week. She traveled to the Mexican border in Texas, then told reporters that conditions at immigrant detention facilities there were uncomfortable for immigrants being held, but said the facilities were clean and appropriate. Also last week, word that a class-action lawsuit linked to the biggest lottery scam in U.S. history was settled for $4.3 million. The settlement will refund the cost of tickets purchased for 9 specific drawing dates for games sold in 33 states between November 2005 and May 2013. A website will be set up to help people who seek refunds. Proof of purchase will not be required to submit a claim for up to 10 non-winning tickets, but settlement administrators will have the right to ask for verification to prevent fraud. Now, all of this is the result of a computer-assisted scam that Eddie Tipton, the former IT director for the Multi-State Lottery Association in Urbandale, ran on the National Lottery. Tipton's scam was not detected for years. He hijacked at least 5 winning drawings totaling more than $24 million. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison in 2017. Last week also brought word that a judge had ruled that Polk County Assessor Randy Rippiger had illegally denied the public access to a list of nearly 2,200 county property owners. The case began a couple of years ago after Rippiger denied the Des Moines Register's request for access to signed forms that allow property owners to remove their property from an online search function. There was also a story about a Baptist minister in Des Moines who had been banned from doing any construction business in Iowa after being accused of taking advantage of numerous low-income customers in home improvement and storm repair jobs. A Polk County judge also ordered the Reverend Dale Gordon Terry, who is an unpaid pastor at the Faith Baptist Church on 3rd Street in Des Moines, to pay more than $51,000 in restitution after he was accused of violating the state's consumer fraud and door-to-door sales acts. There was a strange story indeed out of Council Bluffs last week, a story that became nationwide news. A man whose dead body was found in January at a building that used to house a supermarket was identified as an employee who had gone missing 10 years ago. The man was identified as Larry Ely Murillo Moncada of Council Bluffs. He was 25 years old back in 2009 when he was reported missing. Remains of his body were discovered on January 24th when workers were demolishing the former no-frills supermarket in Council Bluffs. Authorities said the body appeared to have been there for years and that he likely had somehow fallen into a gap between the back of a cooler and a wall and got trapped. Strange indeed. Meanwhile, 2 longtime Eastern Iowa teachers drowned Monday in the pool outside a Davenport home where they were house-sitting. The bodies of Mark Anderson and Kenneth Anderson Jr., who were not related, were found by an acquaintance. In Linn County, authorities said a teenage boy died after a lawnmower overturned and pinned him underneath it. The victim, 17-year-old Alexander Wade Prochaska of Cedar Rapids. The lawnmower overturned when he was trying to mow a ditch. And then there were incidents that took place last week at Ragbri, the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa. First, 3 people were hospitalized during the race last week when a bicycle crash took place near Indianola. They were transported to Des Moines hospitals. Then another bike rider suffered a heart attack. He's expected to recover. The 427-mile ride across Iowa ended this past Saturday in Keokuk, maybe just in time. Also last week, an Iowa police officer resigned after a video was released that showed him striking a motorcyclist during a traffic stop a couple of years ago. Robert Smith resigned after the Durant City Council met in closed session to consider his employment status. Video of that traffic stop shows Smith running from his car with his gun drawn and hitting the motorcyclist with his left hand. In Cedar Rapids, a man already in federal prison on gun convictions was sentenced to another 20 years for trying to hire a hitman from behind bars to kill two northeastern Iowa people. 45-year-old Jason Harriman was convicted last January of two counts of murder for hire. In the state of Rhode Island last week, police arrested an Iowa man who they said intended to visit singer Taylor Swift's beachfront mansion and who was carrying a backpack with a baseball bat with items commonly used in burglaries inside it. 32-year-old David Page Little of Des Moines was picked up after residents reported a suspicious man was at a boatyard near Taylor Swift's home. Authorities said Little told them he was trying to catch up with Swift because he knew her personally and because she had agreed to help him with his career. They do not believe that. Meanwhile, a middle school counselor in the Roland Story School District resigned last week after being accused of trying to solicit an inappropriate relationship with a student. On social media, Michael Olson Jr. said he quit to protect the reputation of the school, but he denied any attempt to have a romantic relationship. Also word last week that the University of Northern Iowa is anticipating its lowest enrollment since 1976, so administrators are cutting courses, increasing class sizes, and reducing the number of faculty members. About 10,600 students are expected to enroll this fall, a 600-student drop from last year. In Indianola last Thursday night, eight people had to be rescued after they got stuck on a ride at the Warren County Fair. The ride is known as the Zipper. It spins upside down, but the people who got stuck were right side up. Go figure. None of them suffered any injuries. Also a report last week that Des Moines is considering expanding hours. The public can visit its 75 parks and considering banning tobacco use at those parks entirely. Right now, people cannot smoke within 25 feet of recreation facilities like playgrounds, but if the city council gives the final okay next month, people would not be able to smoke on any Des Moines Park property, including golf courses and trails. And one more note before we wrap this all up. The Iowa State Fair, as you know, opens on Thursday, August 8th. And guess what's coming back to the fair? Okay, your time's up. The answer? Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest is coming back. That's what. Now, this competition is going to take place at 1 o'clock, Saturday afternoon, August 10th. Make a note of that. Whichever man and whichever woman wins will qualify for the really big event next year, Nathan's 4th of July International Hot Dog Eating Contest at Coney Island in Brooklyn. And there, the State Fair winners will get to take on reigning hot dog eating champs Joey Chestnut and Mickey Sudo. Now, just so you know, Ursula, Chestnut and Sudo are big, big-time hot dog chuggers. Chestnut won this year's competition at Coney Island by consuming 71 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. Wow. 71. And Mickey Sudo.
With the buns, that's a lot.
With the buns.
That's a lot, yeah.
And you think so? 71?
With the buns, yeah.
Mickey Sudo won the women's competition by downing 31 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. Now, as for me, just have to tell you, anything more than two hot dogs in 10 minutes will send me in search of that pink stuff that soothes your stomach. You know what I'm talking about.
Wow.
And that's your summary of the week's news from around Iowa.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Kings is having a big rummage sale. It's that time of year when students are leaving.
Yep.
Their apartments. And so Ames is holding Rummage Rampage.
It's a great deal. It's over at the Intermodal Facility on Hayward Avenue, just south of campus. And the way it works is, you know, all that stuff that the students would throw out on the curb when they're moving out would go into a landfill normally. Well,
right.
The idea is that you could donate that, and people can come. A lot of people want to come and buy stuff like that. And it keeps every year thousands of pounds of material would go into the landfill, out of the landfill, and raises money for nonprofits.
The rummage sale is run by volunteers from a lot of different nonprofit groups, including KHOI. And we thank everybody that has been there on behalf of KHOI. Dennis, you and I ran into each other there working.
We didn't injure each other when we ran into each other. But yes, we were among several KHOI people who were there.
So while I was there, I recorded some of the voices of the people at the Rummage Rampage, and I wanted to bring those to Local Talk this morning, give people a sense of what's going on, and also to maybe encourage you, if you hear this, to check out and see what's going on down there.
Hi, I'm
Deb Fennelly,
sitting at the table where small items come in, and we weigh everything that comes in so that we know how many pounds of stuff does not go into the landfill.
What organization are you representing?
I'm with Altrusa. 22.8. Okay.
What are you weighing in?
Oh, I brought two pens and a calculator. I'm done with that. I'm moving out, so too much stuff to take now. Might as well just let somebody else use it.
You're a student.
Graduated. Yeah.
Thank you for donating.
So this is your household?
Part of it.
Okay. Tell us what you're bringing us.
A plant stand, because we are moving out of the Ames area.
Susan Guiasta, you're one of the main organizers here. How's it going? We're talking on Sunday evening.
Yeah, it's hard to remember what day it is. It's been so busy. It's been such a wonderful community turnout, both with the donations and with the sales. We had a record-breaking first day.
How much?
On our first day of sales, $9,479.
And how much did you make total last year?
About $18,000.
So on the first day, you made half.
Yep, we're halfway to last year's total. Pretty amazing. The next days are never as big as that first opening day, but we're pretty encouraged by just the ongoing support, the donations continue to pour in, and the sales are going strong.
Why aren't we selling clothes here?
Oh, it's just something we decided not to do. Our purpose was really, again, in a college community, you see a lot of the housewares and furniture on the curbside. We want to get that turnover. We're focusing on housewares, furniture, outdoor kinds of items.
So you're representing the city. Does it feel good to get the objects off the street, off the curb?
I think everybody who works this event is committed to the idea of keeping usable items out of the landfill. It benefits everybody in this community.
Laurie Hansen
from Resource Recovery Plant. We just kind of facilitate. All the money goes back to the nonprofits that are helping us so much with this thing.
What are some of the items that are selling first?
Vacuum cleaners. Vacuum cleaners were hot this morning, yes.
How long does the rampage continue? How long can people buy things here?
We will continue through next Saturday, and next Saturday will be a half price day from 8 to 2.
And are new things keep coming in all the time?
All the time through Friday. It might be worth coming every single day just to see what's here.
And you can still bring things the whole week, right?
You can still bring things the whole week, yes. We can always use more couches and chairs and other furniture, housewares, things like that.
And what are the hours again?
Through the week, it'll be noon to 6, and then next Saturday, 8 to 2.
Would you say what organization you're here representing?
I'm with the BBMB Club, Biochemistry, Biophysics, and Molecular Biology.
That's a student club?
Yes. Yeah, we put on an undergraduate research symposium every year, and this is one of our big sources of funding for that.
So this is to pay for a symposium for students?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Undergraduates, graduates, and then we invite speakers from other universities. We had someone from Yale last year and different places like that.
So what's the most interesting thing you've seen so far?
My favorite and most interesting thing is a Miller Lite light-up sign.
How big is it?
3x4, I would say. That sounds about right.
Does it work?
Yeah, it does. I tried it out. It worked. And a brand new plunger.
You're with Legal Aid?
Yeah.
What will the money get used for?
Legal Aid represents residents of Story County whose income level for their family size is at or below 125%. And we do civil services that you can't get a court-appointed counsel for. I want people to come and buy and drop stuff off. And yes, absolutely.
Who are you volunteering for?
NAMI Central Iowa.
What kind of services will this money that you earn be transformed into?
Getting mental health services and resources.
It's Unity Church of Ames.
And the money, what will it get transformed into?
We are a smaller sized community church, very active in the community. We help local pet shelters, help YSS, and in several other ways as well. We've had several capital projects, one of them replacing our floor in our community room, as well as replacing a hail damaged shingles on our roof.
What was one really unique item you saw come in today that one could buy here?
A pulley from 1920. It's labeled as a historic item or an antique. I'm not sure why the gentleman brought it, but he brought it, and I just had to laugh.
I'm volunteering with the Student Association for Sustainable Agriculture.
The money that you earn here, what will it transform into?
We're going to be using it for graduate students in the Sustainable Agriculture program at ISU to have the opportunity to go to agricultural professional conferences. And then we'll also use the money to bring in documentary films and speakers to help educate the general public in Ames about sustainable agriculture.
I am volunteering for the Green Umbrella,
a student organization.
Yeah.
And the money that you earn here, how will it be used?
To promote sustainability in the Iowa State and Ames community.
The dish set.
Sunshine flowers.
It's a Heartside Garden Festival stoneware. It's hand-painted, made in the 1970s in Japan. So it's pretty valuable and rare stoneware. Looks like we have at least one, if not two, complete sets of that.
And what group are you representing?
The Pride Alliance.
So you're a student group?
Yes, we are. We serve the students by providing open and safe space for people to express and be who they are and also learn more about the LGBT community. And
what does the money here get used for?
Help pay for a conference that we go to every year. The money goes towards paying for registration, paying for hotels and transportation so that we don't have to pass on as much of the cost to students.
Is there an item that stands out in your mind?
Yesterday we got a beer pong table and a giant curio cabinet. It had glass doors on the top half and then wooden doors on the bottom half so that you can put things in it and see them through the glass doors.
We've got all the big pieces on this end.
The furniture department. Who are you volunteering for?
Actors.
What's the nicest thing you've seen?
There is a green occasional chair up at the top on the right side. We've all taken turns sitting in it because it is so comfortable and it's beautiful. I'll tell you, it's worth a lot, but it won't be charged a lot. But it's a comfortable chair and it's in great shape.
So let's see, we found a steering wheel cover, a dog bowl, elevator, I guess, a little mini ironing board, and some powered hedge trimmers.
It's a chainsaw.
Yes, ma'am. It is a chainsaw,
does
indeed.
It work?
I don't know. We'll have to grab an extension cord when it comes in. That's kind of the fun of the event is as stuff comes in, we can then use it to kind of test other things.
Where did you find this chainsaw thingy?
I found this on Campus Avenue. Yeah, just lying down on the street. A lot of folks will just leave stuff out on their driveways and I'll come grab it.
Gloria Betcher, you're in the rare finds section.
Yeah, we have some pretty unique items here, Ursula.
You have a wooden wheelchair.
Yes, that looks like an invalid chair from maybe the early 20th century. It's an antique item, and it actually works, and people say it's comfortable.
It's all wood. There's no cushion on it. And you have a number of sea chests, trunks, that are quite beautiful.
Yes, we have some beautiful dome-top trunks and a wooden footlocker, a steamer trunk that might have been used for those traveling across the ocean on, well, let's say, the Queen Mary? I don't know. Imagine.
Absolutely.
And some of these trunks are in absolutely immaculate condition.
Wow. And then over here you have a very unique piece of furniture.
Yes, it is a rather ornate high boy buffet with linen drawers and cabinet, and it has an interesting inlay across the cornice of the piece and heavy carving across the front. Probably from the Edwardian period, 19-teens to the 20s.
Gloria, next door here is a section of objects that may or may not find a home. It's kind of make an offer. Talk a little bit about the art of selling these kind of unwanted objects.
One of the most difficult things about selling these objects that need a home is helping people envision how easy it would be to fix them in a way that would make them usable again, or just what they could do with that item, because there are in fact some really strange things that we've received. I think the one that has attracted the most attention is a rather large podium sort of thing that was apparently a table in the Premier Credit Union that was used for filling out deposit slips and writing checks.
Wow.
And we've been trying to sell it as an entertainment console that you could put a nice ice bucket in, stick some bottles of wine or beer in there, and have friends gather around it.
Somebody's looking at it right now, and they walked away looking very unconvinced.
It has attracted a lot of attention, and it, like every other item in that section, is make an offer.
Does making suggestions help sell the items?
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Ursula.
Keep up the good work here.
Tell people to keep coming down.
I want to tell people about this awesome bundle that we have here at the Rummage Rand page in the holidays items. We have organized gift and party packs, hand assembled. We put bows on them for Christmas and Halloween and for that special person in your life that you just don't know what to get. We got a party pack here with two vintage perfumes from Hawaii.
What kind of party is that?
And they're in a little Opals memorabilia showcase. It is a piggy bank. It's also a drinking mug. And there's two vintage perfume bottles inside. So I don't know what it means, but it just says regret. And
it's not working yet.
No, it has poor life choices.
It needs more. We're going to find something.
It just makes me sad to look at that.
Come over here. Flashing beer mugs. So not only can you make your own beer, you can drink it in your flashing beer mugs in the Irish hat. A happy-go-lucky Friday night.
This is a marketing concept. You're assembling random objects and you're putting them together so they gain meaning. And you've wrapped them in plastic.
Value. Don't forget.
Which organization are you representing?
I am working for Access.
And what will the money be used for that you get from this?
They help people get out of domestic abuse situations. Since I'm a domestic abuse survivor, I wanted to help them out.
Sharon, who are you representing today? Who are you working for?
I'm here for the Ames Historical Society.
Part of the money will go to the Ames History Center?
Ames History Museum, yes. And what a great place to come and shop. It's amazing.
You've been working with small objects?
Yes, I'm part of exquisite pricing and bundling. Amazing selection, amazing, from vintage to clothes baskets and ice cream makers. Beer makers, we have a beer making kit. Yeah, please come. Irish party bundles, Christmas party bundles, beer party bundles, mystery bags, Halloween party bundles. It's amazing, amazing stuff. Come on, you guys, get over here. You got to get over here and buy it.
So finally, I'm here with Mary Rankin, who is Sustainability Manager for the City of Ames and Iowa State University, one of the managers of this event.
I'm one of a team of city and university employees that are here making this event happen.
This is really a collaborative event here happening not only between the city and the university, but lots and lots of service organizations.
Oh my goodness, yes. This year we have 22 nonprofit organizations that have donated at least 10 hours of volunteer service to the event. So if you do the math, that's over 200 hours. It would not be possible without this absolute community effort from all of these people. It does really work like a well-oiled machine, even though it looks like a lot of chaos going on because we have so many things coming in and so many things going out. But really, it has worked so well. This year we added traffic controllers, and that has been a great addition. And we also have folks that stay here overnight and just meet and greet people that may come to look at things, may come to pick up things that they have purchased, and just are wondering what's going on at the ramp.
And you also have somebody who's driving around town, picking up things, delivering things, and also taking things off the street that could be sold.
That's actually one of my team members, and he's fantastic. He enjoys doing that, and he has developed quite a great rapport around town as he's seeing people moving out and saying, hey, if you have anything that you don't want, we've got this great event. If you're not able to transport it, here, you know, I'll take it for you. And then he's also been really wonderful and helpful in offering for those folks that may not have transportation to be able to help them in getting things to their homes. So
finally,
All the things are weighed when they come in. How much was moved last year?
Actually, it was about 51 tons of material last year. It's so interesting to see what people bring in, and I think a lot of decisions from folks about what is going into the dumpster, particularly are folks that are moving out of Ames. You know, they finish their degrees, they finish their leases, they've got a new job, they're moving. And a lot of things end up in the dumpster that are brand new. And so we've been seeing a lot of brand new items come in. Some items, you know, still in their original box. And then the other thing, too, is we've had a lot of vintage things come in that people have had for a number of years and they find they no longer need. There's some really unique finds.
It's all the way from very large furniture, office supplies, outdoor equipment, to kitchen supplies and no clothes, but some greeting cards. So it's a big spectrum. We have some beautiful bicycles here tonight.
Yes.
And lots of exercise machines.
We do have every section of your home, indoors and outdoors, represented here with items that might be beneficial for you, all really reasonably priced. So even if you may want to, you know, go garage selling or go pick items up at, you know, different places, I really encourage folks to come down. You can just check a few items off your list at much less the cost and really helping out our community. It's going to be hard to drive around to individual garage sales to find all of these things. And for a lot of people, they don't necessarily have the time to have a garage sale. And so they've just been looking for an event like this that supports our nonprofit organizations in our community. Please consider bringing them down and donating them, because they do go to those in need in our community. It's a win-win situation.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be here all week, right?
I will be here all week. So for those of you who hear this, please come down, say hello. We would love to see you down at Rummage Rampage.
Okay, thanks, Mary.
Take care. It's my pleasure.
Yeah.
The Romantics, and that's somehow appropriate on this Monday, and it's Local Talk. I'm Dennis Hart, and you're Ursula Rudenberg.
KHOI's environmental reporter Pat Schlarbaum had a check-in with Irv Kloss, ISU professor emeritus, to talk about climate crisis, you know, how things are looking right now, and also in anticipation of the upcoming presidential debate on the national level.
Well, today in the KHOI studios, quite pleased to introduce Irv Kloss, professor emeritus from Iowa State University, and welcome to Local Talk.
Thanks, Pat.
And just for some background, I understand a lot of your career was spent on the East Coast.
I only spent 4 years in the East Coast. I was working on effects of DDT on birds, and both collecting specimens from the environment of nesting birds, but also doing studies in pen, we call them pen studies, birds kept in aviaries and fed different kinds of chemicals in order to see what the effects are.
There seemed to be an era in the early 1970s there, the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act. There were some regulatory measures that were applied, and so I kind of want to make a comparison to what, how do you feel the country was addressing those concerns at that time and where we're at today with, well, climate change?
Yeah, those were exciting times. We had Cayuga River in Cleveland caught fire.
Yeah, right.
And that brought a lot of attention. And people began to be concerned about water quality and the pollution, air pollution and water pollution, both. And also the effects of pesticides on our health.
So right.
Those were really times when laws were being passed under the Nixon administration that I think are still in effect in many of them, and they're very important to us.
So in the current climate, if you will, politically, we've got a situation that many are referring to as an emergency concerning climate change.
Climate change is an emergency. It is a crisis, and those of us who are knowledgeable about it are thinking we really have to act quickly and now, because this earth is in danger. I was watching on public television last night the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, and I was thinking how far we've come since then, 50 years. And looking back at the earth from the moon, we have that famous photograph of the earth sticking out there in the middle of the universe, and thinking about how fragile it was, and it still is, and we are fragile. I guess the book that has affected me a lot has been by James Hansen, probably the foremost scientist on climate in the world. And he wrote in 2009 the book Storms of My Grandchildren. And he said in 1988, he told the Senate committee at the U.S. Congress that the Earth was warming and that we had to do something about it. And ever since then, he's been working hard to explain this phenomenon to people and try to do something about it. And he's almost in desperation now. He said that he feels that the only thing he can do now is to go to the courts and try to get the courts to do something. And that's his granddaughter, Sophie, is part of our Children's Trust, which is a group of young people who have filed suit against the government for endangering their life, liberty, and property, and under the Constitution, the First Amendment. That lawsuit has been moving steadily through the courts, and even though the government, beginning in 2015 with President Obama's administration, the government has been trying to get it thrown out of court, but have not been successful. It's now an appeals court in San Francisco is deliberating whether or not to throw it out of the court system. And if it follows the pattern that's been established in the last several years, they will allow it to go to trial. And we're waiting for that decision to come out.
Will that create an atmosphere that will be comparable to when you mentioned the Cuyahoga River catching on fire? And I think in America at that time, rivers don't burn. And that one was. Right. And it just ramped up the necessity of addressing some of these regulatory
It seems like
travesties.
In this country we have to have big catastrophes in order to get people's attention. And we're already having these catastrophes, depending on where you are. I mean, the wildfires in the West, California, Oregon, Washington, all the way up into Canada, the forests are burning. And there's a very strong indication that this is caused by global warming. And not only that, but the sea level is rising, and we're faced with melting glaciers and melting ice sheets around the world, and it is an emergency. And since the federal government has abdicated their responsibility to protect us, we have, here in Ames, a group of people have joined together to try to convince the local governments to do something here. And if a lot of local governments did this, we would have a movement, I think. And there is a movement going on. And in fact, there have been several cities declare states of emergency. Hoboken, New Jersey, which was greatly affected by Hurricane Sandy a few years ago, they have decided that in order to protect their city, which is 3/4 of it at sea level, they need to do something. Well, the city of New York has declared an emergency. And you know, you think about why would they declare a state of emergency? Well, it's to bring an attention to the public that this is a crisis, and also to set goals to do something. You know, we didn't go to the moon before we knew how. We set a goal. President Kennedy said we'll go to the moon within this decade, and the scientists at NASA and the engineers worked hard to meet that goal. And it's amazing what they did in 10 years. That's what we should do now. We should mobilize just like we did at World War II. We should mobilize just like we did to go to the moon. and lots of other things that we've done in this country. It has to be on a global basis, but the U.S. is the main leader of the world, and we should take that responsibility and go with it.
Well, and it's, so as a topic for debate and also the opportunity to go to our city councils and kind of keep this conversation going. So we're in the midst of a political era, and here we are. Is it? I understand that the Democratic National Committee is kind of downgrading the...
Well, that's an interesting story, too, because a lot of candidates now for the presidency, Democratic presidents, candidates, have indicated that they want to have a debate on climate. And it's not whether or not there is a, you know, that there's global warming. It's whether or not we should have a tax on carbon or not. In fact, debate what the solutions are, mm-hmm. not whether or not it exists. And that's what they're saying. And the Democratic National Committee is made up of a lot of longtime activists in the party. And they have been very slow to do things that I feel are progressive. And to give you an indication, why don't they want to have this debate? Well, I just learned recently that they have accepted about $700,000 from the fossil fuel companies to finance the Democratic Convention next summer. Well, you see why they're not doing this?
Yeah,
well. Is that they have – the money is there. The fossil fuel companies don't want this debate. They influence the right people to stop it. So it's really hard in this era of democracy that we're doing this, because I think to be fully democratic, we've got to start eliminating these vested interests that are trying to stop things that are essentially their own self-interest.
Well, and it seems to be an issue of social justice as far as the impacts of global warming, climate change, and how does not addressing the climate change discussion, basically countries that are sea level type existences.
Yeah, all around the United States, there are people that live in marginal areas that are going to be affected the most. People who can't move from those areas. I've been in California, and some of the areas in the coastal range are what we call chaparral of vegetation, and it's uninhabited for the most part, but there's lots of young poor people live there because they can't find affordable housing elsewhere. They go up into the mountains and try to find a place where they can camp or maybe take a trailer, a camping trailer or something, and live out of that. And that's the areas that are most prone to burn. And they catch fire. These people don't have any place to go. So it's, but not only that, but people who have nice homes, and the campfire last year in Northern California that destroyed that town called Paradise, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And they lost 85 lives in that thing.
It seems to be somewhat daunting. We are in an activated political era. What would you like to encourage our listeners to do?
Somebody said recently, you can't do it alone. You've got to join a group. Churches have been doing this somewhat. Last year, we formed the Climate Action Team here in Ames. I was amazed because we had invited all the churches in Ames to send representatives to that, to a first organizing meeting. We didn't know what was going to organize or not. We just wanted to talk about the social justice issues as they related to climate. And we had 90 people show up. And from that, there was a consensus that we needed to continue to work together. And from that, we formed the Climate Action Team. And we've been meeting monthly ever since to try to come up with ideas for solutions. And the first one of those was to go to the city council and ask them to declare emergency. They would not do it. But they did listen, and I think many on the council have been listening. But they started this discussion among them, the community, about the comprehensive plan, and that's, again, to plan for growth. And part of the problem we have with climate change is that we're addicted to growth, economic growth, population growth, everything. Everybody seems to think that that's a positive thing. Mm-hmm. And it really isn't. We have to somehow contain the growth. And we're really not, in the United States, we're really not growing in population. It's just people moving around and cities competing with one another for these people to come and improve their economies. I think that we've got to recognize that in a democracy, we've got to listen to the people. And I think the people are saying right now, this is a crisis and we've got to do something about it. And really, there are already scientists and people knowledgeable about this that are saying it's too late. And it's very depressing to hear that said. I have hope that we can do something and curtail this, but the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is the culprit, continue to go up. They have not declined one iota with all the work that's been done with the Kyoto Agreement back in the 90s, and later the Copenhagen Agreement, and then the Paris Accord. None of these have accomplished the goal of reducing carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide in the atmosphere comes from, not all of it comes from the burning of fossil fuels, but a good share of it does. Mm-hmm. And that's the easiest part to stop, I think.
Thank you, Dr. Herb Kloss. And is there any other parting bits of wisdom?
Well, just continue to have hope, I guess.
Thank you, sir. Hope is a very powerful message.
Thank you, Pat, and thank you, Mr. Kloss, for the update. Speaking of updates, we have a new coffee shop in town.
Yeah, and I understand this one is straight out of Clear Lake, a pretty famous little coffee shop.
Cabin Coffee, and this is the coffee shop that Pat Schlarbaum goes to now.
Apparently his favorite. Let's hear about it.
We're at Cabin Coffee here on 13th Street with the owner. And how about if you start by giving your name and where you're from?
I'm Tammy Jacobson. I'm from originally from Britt, Iowa, but we've lived here in Gilbert, Iowa for 22 years now, I think. Yeah.
And you own the business with your husband, Paul?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. My husband, Paul Jacobson, he works for the Gilbert School District. He's a guidance counselor, a high school guidance counselor, and we own the business together. We roast our own beans here on site. We do not brew anything or sell anything after 2 weeks because the fresher the bean, the better the flavor, the more intense the flavor and taste. So everybody's getting the freshest roasted beans.
You serve breakfast all day long?
Yes, so we have breakfast and we also have lunch sandwiches and they are made to order and then we can switch out the breads if someone wants a different kind of a bagel, like an everything bagel with eggs, cheese, and ham or something like that. We can switch everything around. We do fresh bake quite a bit of items, like our bagels, they come in par baked, but we do bake them. And then also we do pastry items like raspberry danishes, scones. Our scones are super delicious. Cookies and fun stuff like that.
Oh, please include your parfaits because it's a real favorite of mine.
Yes, your fruit and yogurt parfaits. They are so delicious and refreshing, especially for summertime, right?
How did you first learn about Cabin Coffee and also your intimate relationship with coffee? When did that start?
Well, My husband's been the one that loves the coffee the most. I've grown to really love coffee, especially that we roast here on site. I've always loved the smell of coffee. I just couldn't find the right kind that I really loved, and now I know what I really love.
And what would that be?
It's a cold press. Any of the flavored cold press that we make here is super delicious. It's smooth, it's less acidic, it's so good, and it's highly caffeinated, which is wonderful. But we first knew of Cabin Coffee in Clear Lake. It is a franchise. The franchisors own the two stores, Clear Lake and the Mason City store, and there's 19 stores altogether. We're store number 18. 19 just opened a month ago in Avon, Indiana. But we've been going to Cabin Coffee since they first opened. And then my husband grew up in Forest City, Iowa, which they also have a Cabin Coffee there, and they've just celebrated their 10-year anniversary. So, gone there for 10 years, too.
Have you had other businesses?
No, we have not. Nope, I worked in the daycare for 13 years prior to this, so yeah.
Well, so you came to Ames thinking there might be a niche here. We're on 13th Street, just off the interstate. I might mention that I live in this community, in this neighborhood, about 5 miles from here. So this makes it really handy for me to come and enjoy your coffee and also your meeting rooms and things here. So what is it about your location that you found appealing?
We loved that it had a drive-through. We loved that there's a lot of local businesses, big businesses like the Hawk and Dan Foss and big industries, Martin Marietta, a lot of clinics around here that are super close, and so they've been very supportive of Cabin Coffee. And also that we're close to the interstate, which helps give those interstate travelers to come in. It's been very, very good. And then we've also had local people, a lot of local people come out and are regulars and just have been very, the whole town of Ames has been
so great. You're growing your regular base. How was it with the employment when you first decided to set up your business here?
Well, we had a lot of interest even before, when we first announced that we were coming to Ames, people were starting to contact us. Actually, the manager here, Jill, contacted us when soon as she found out that we were opening. She had been out to the Cabin Coffee out in Breckenridge, Colorado, and that's how she knew a Cabin Coffee. And so she instantly called us up and said, I would love to apply. So she was our first hire, and then from then on we just did through social media, and it was quite easy. We got a lot of applicants. People still ask us if we're still hiring now, but we're all set for this fall. So.
And I do notice whenever I stop in, there are people, obviously from the local businesses here along 13th Street, that are utilizing you as a destination to get together for coffee. Mm-hmm. And I might just point out your decor is rather rustic. Is there anything that you find that you like most about the Cabin Coffee decor?
I do. I love our fun little sayings on the wall. I love that we actually sell the stuff on our wall, which is kind of fun. There always seem to be some kind of a cowboy-themed or a coffee-themed fun saying on them. I just love this saying of just be happy and have fun.
Be joyful, value friendship, have a cup with a friend when the day begins. And also, I see a touch of barn boards around some of the framing on some of your images. Is there any story about the barn boards?
I grew up on a farm, and they tore down their barn, and I kept all the barn wood for like probably a good 10 years, knowing that hopefully someday we would open a Cabin Coffee. So wherever you see, like above the roasting room, the meeting room, above the bathrooms, is all my father's barn wood. And then also we have along the back wall framed big bags of beans, and those are all my dad's barnwood also. Yeah. My parents have been a great support, and as soon as we put up the barnwood, I took pictures and sent it to him, and I'm like, do you recognize it? And he was super excited, tickled pink, but yeah.
Your new business here on 13th Street, welcome to the neighborhood, community of businesses. Well, it sounds like you're doing everything you can to welcome your visitors and your customers to come by and have a really positive experience, and I really want to thank you for having some moments here today to share this with the KHOI listeners, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your time. Yeah.
Thank you, Pat Schlarbaum. And you've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Dennis Hart. Thank you for listening to us this hour.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. And remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelly. You also heard What I Like About You by The Romantics and Non-Alcoholic by, who was that, Dennis?
That was Wynton Marcel.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. Come and join the Local Talk team.
And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.